Hello, welcome to this live webcast on Medical Crossfire, expert interpretations of the latest data in CLL management, understanding the impact of optimal treatment selection on patient outcomes. Thank you very much for joining us. The data are really coming fast and furious in CLL, so I think you'll really enjoy the next hour. I'm Jennifer Brown, the Worthington and Margaret Collette Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School and Director of the CLL Center at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. I'm pleased to be moderating this evening's discussion. I'm joined today by Dr. Danilov. If he could please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Alexey Danilov. I'm a physician scientist specializing in care of patients with CLL and lymphoma. I'm also director of early phase therapeutics program at City of Hope National Medical Center in Los Angeles, California.
And by Dr. Davids.
Hi, everyone. Matt Davids. I'm an associate professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School and leader of the lymphoma program at the Dana-Farber Harvard Cancer Center. I also direct our clinical research program in our division of lymphoma at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute in Boston.
So our first section is on assessing the implications of recent developments in CLL management. So several emerging themes that I think we've seen over the last 6 months to a year in CLL therapy, including at the American Society of Hematology meeting this past December, include the arrival of time-limited 2- and 3-drug regimens. So the 2-drug regimens, of course, are BTK inhibitors with venetoclax for now, but there are also novel BCL-2 inhibitors coming along. And then there's the option potentially to add a CD20 antibody to make a 3-drug regimen. And then the question arises, when do we use BTK inhibitor with BCL-2 inhibitor, or when do we use venetoclax CD20, venetoclax obinutuzumab, the regimen that has been around for a while? And then when using these time-limited regimens, what is the role of MRD? I think it's been brought home to us continually with some of the new relapse data that double refractory disease, that is disease in which patients have had disease progression on both a covalent BTK inhibitor and venetoclax, really does remain a significant new unmet need with quite poor outcomes for these patients. We have fortunately seen 2 approvals in that space over the last little bit over a year. This includes the first non-covalent BTK inhibitor, pirtobrutinib, as well as CAR T therapy for CLL, liso-cel. We've also seen emerging data about resistance mutations, particularly to covalent BTK inhibitors. And so the role, if any, of potentially looking at resistance mutations as we sequence therapy is an emerging theme. And then we have promising new drugs, bispecific antibodies, where epcoritamab has the most data in CLL, as well as BTK degraders. So I'd like to ask my colleagues on the panel what they think the implications are of some of these new data for our patients. Dr. Davids?
Yeah, I can start. I mean, I think the biggest change coming very soon is the likely approval this year of the BTK-BCL2 doublet here in the U.S. and possibly the triplet also. This is acalabrutinib venetoclax with or without obinutuzumab. So right now we've sort of had this choice of time-limited therapy with venetoclax obinutuzumab or continuous treatment with the BTK inhibitors. And very soon we're going to have a new option to discuss with patients. And I think a lot of patients will like the idea of a time-limited therapy that's all oral, without the need for infusions. And then we'll see some of the data with the triplet, which also for patients who may want to explore further and maybe don't mind going through an infusion.
Yeah, I completely agree with Dr. Davids. As many of our patients are older with median age of diagnosis of 70, 72 years old, it is exciting to see safer treatments being introduced in CLL. And I still remember the time when chemoimmunotherapy was really the only option, say 15 years ago. And now we are heading towards the doublet regimens, which are incredibly safe with selective BTK inhibitors. So I do agree with Dr. Davids that this will again revolutionize the field. I think we will see use of these doublets increasingly frequently. In the United States, ibrutinib and venetoclax is a very popular treatment regimen in Europe where it is approved, and I think we will see similar results here. And Dr. Brown, you mentioned some new agents such as BTK degraders, epcoritamab. There is CAR T-cell therapy. So what now that we are in the chemo-free space, it is exciting to see some new developments in which will be relevant to patients who have high-risk disease and who will progress on BCL-2 inhibitors and BTK inhibitors.
Exactly. I mentioned that patients who have progressed on both those agents, the so-called double refractory ones, are clearly a big unmet need now. But there's also an unmet need, particularly for our younger patients who have IGHV unmutated higher risk disease, to try and prevent them from becoming double refractory. Do you see advances there? Maybe those are the patients who might benefit from three drug regimens, for example.
Yeah, I agree. I think those are patients where you really want to try to drive as deep of a remission as possible and hopefully achieve a long progression-free survival. And hopefully, if you can do that with the triplet-based regimens, you can actually then retreat with the same drugs. It's kind of a common question we all get, I'm sure. You know, if you use these great drugs early on, what do you do afterwards? But hopefully, the answer for most patients is actually you just reuse those same drugs again if they've achieved a good initial remission. There will probably be a smaller subset of patients who don't have a good remission to that initial approach with BTK and BCL2, and that's going to define an even higher risk group of patients double refractory. But as Dr. Danilov is saying, you know, it's great to have these other new options coming along with the degraders and bispecific antibodies, which could be a good option for those patients as well.
Yeah, I agree. And I think we are increasingly in this era of precision medicine where all these genetic prognostic factors are very important. Of course, p53 aberrations have been very critical to evolution of therapy in CLL, where we realized that chemoimmunotherapy really doesn't work well in these patients, and targeted therapies have really supplanted that chemoimmunotherapy in those patients a long time ago. And now I think we will be able to figure out who are the best patients for triplet versus doublet therapy. I will say to this day, today, it's still a bit unclear. The data is still quite immature that Dr. Davids will talk about. But I believe that 5 years from now, we will have much more clarity and we will be able to tailor our therapies to individual patients much better.
That's actually a good segue into our next slide, where we have the NCCN preferred regimens, which we used to break down by fitness, which age was a surrogate for fitness, and by 17p deletion. We're still breaking it down by with and without 17p deletion, but you can see that categories are shockingly similar. This is the hot off the presses version because the Icalavenant plus minus obinutuzumab has been recently added along with Van-Oben and along with BTK inhibitors frontline. What do you think about the current guidelines? You think they're helpful for practice?
So I can start on that one. I actually don't find them to be that helpful, at least this distinction now between 17p deletion or not. Obviously, that's still a very important and relevant factor and does influence treatment choice. But as you alluded to, the options look very similar. So I think for me, more useful in practice would be guidelines that maybe said patient prefers time-limited therapy or continuous therapy or certain comorbidities. You know, patient has cardiovascular comorbidities or these sorts of things. Like, I think sort of a tree kind of building off of that might be more helpful in practice. I do think this format here summarizes nicely all the available options and the level of evidence, but I feel like it's not as practical as maybe it used to be when we were trying to between chemoimmunotherapy or a targeted therapy, for example, in the early days of ibrutinib.
Right. I agree. I think this is a nice summary, and part of one role for NCCN guidelines is, of course, help smooth insurance approvals for some of these regimens. And it's really exciting to see Ven/Acala plus minus obinutuzumab there, as I personally have used that regimen as standard of care already. But I agree with Matt, and some of that will be in the text, of course. But the trouble is, busy community oncologists don't always have the time to to conduct a detailed study of the manuscript which accompanies this NCCN guidelines. So a schema which would guide the decision for frontline therapy or second line, third line therapy would be very helpful for these guidelines.
To some extent, second line therapy choice has gotten a little easier because you use classically just whatever you didn't use frontline. Although if with a time limited regimen, you can repeat it, but we don't have data on that yet. So it's gotten more complicated. Now we also have another slide sort of summarizing some of the selections. So on the left, we have the prognostic markers, mutated versus unmutated versus 17p deletion. Then we have the treatment-related logistics, and then we have the side effects highlighted in terms of we have the three covalent BTKs on top, then we have acala and ven-obin, and then this has ibrutinib venetoclax because this is from prior to the acala-ven and also with the ibrutinib venetoclax regimen being approved in Europe. Perhaps one of you could take us through what you think about the prognostic factors on the left. We've been doing Dr. David's first, so.
Yeah, I could start. I mean, I generally agree with the principle of the heat map. I actually do find this to be somewhat useful, even though, it's a little bit sort of nuanced how you think about each drug. Like, certainly with the continuous BTK inhibitors, to me it's not a huge difference there in mutated IGHV, like whether I'd use ibrutinib or acalabrutinib with, I think with regard to obviously adverse events, there's differences there. I do tend to favor obinutuzumab venetoclax for the mutated IGHV group, and that is reflected in this heat map here with the darker green. On the unmutated IGHV side, that's I think really the most challenging situation right now, where either time limited or continuous therapy is a great option. And then this nicely highlights in the heat map how for the patients with TP53 aberration, either deletion 17p or a mutation in TP53, we are still generally favoring continuous BTK inhibitor based therapy. And again, based on AE comparisons, primarily acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib would be preferred over ibrutinib.
Right. So, I think this becomes very physician specific, and patient preference really goes into this quite a bit. I think the main distinction still remains between time-limited therapies versus continuous therapies. And I will say that a lot of my patients do prefer time-limited therapy, particularly younger patients for probably obvious reasons. And I think while genetics is really important, it is often the clinical presentation that in my practice still trumps this decision. If I anticipate severe infusion reactions, logistical difficulties with administering obinutuzumab as part of the ven-obin regimen, I may be or certain comorbidities, I may be skewed towards one or another. But again, I will say that the majority of patients do seem to prefer time-limited therapies. Again, I think this will shift a little bit again with the approval of pending approval of acalabrutinib venetoclax plus minus obinutuzumab, where it is possible that more patients will be eligible and good candidates for these regimens compared to what is happening now because of the lead-in with acalabrutinib, which makes subsequent steps easier. And in terms of genetics, I agree with Dr. Davidson in principle. However, none of these regimens have really been compared so well head to head, and there is in terms we don't know that one is better in terms of overall survival than another for one genetic subtype versus another genetic subtype. So to me, I will have to admit it becomes a bit of a secondary consideration. Even for deletion 17p TP53 aberrant disease, it's not that venetoclax obinutuzumab doesn't work. We just know it doesn't work for as long as BTK inhibitors. Having said that, we are comparing apples and oranges, meaning finite duration therapy versus continuous therapy. So I don't know what would happen if we treated these patients in frontline with venetoclax continuously. So I will say that even though it is a nice graph, it is a nice heat map. To me, it bears less less meaning than other factors in terms of genetics.
Okay, well, the middle panel does cover logistics and
Yeah.
comorbidities are covered on the right. So I think to a first approximation, it's a reasonable summary, but everything is a detailed discussion with the patient and evaluation of each individual patient. With that, why don't we review some of the data? Dr. Davids is going to take us through optimizing outcomes with target approaches in frontline therapy.
Great. Thanks, Dr. Brown. So, some of the data for the drugs that we're talking about, going back to ibrutinib to start. And although we're not using ibrutinib as much as we used to, I think it is important to recognize the revolutionary role that this drug has played in the management of CLL over the past 15 years or so since it went into clinical trials. And I wanted to illustrate a couple of points that I think are important with ibrutinib, which I think are also reflected with the other BTK inhibitors. The first, as you see on the left from the US Alliance study, clearly ibrutinib with or without rituximab is superior to chemo immunotherapy, either in TP53 aberrant or wild type patients. But one of the things that I found very remarkable about the graph on the left is that the patients treated with ibrutinib-based therapy continuously had similar outcomes in terms of PFS, whether they had a TP53 abnormality or not. This is really unprecedented in the history of CLL. Whenever we used chemo immunotherapy, as you can see with BR, patients who had TP53 abnormal disease had a much shorter progression-free survival. So, this is something we've also seen with other covalent BTK inhibitors now, but really the longest follow-up is with ibrutinib. And that's particularly illustrated on the right. This is 10-year data from the original phase II NHLBI study. This is ibrutinib as a single agent, continuous monotherapy in a population of patients with TP53 aberration. And you see this excellent 10-year overall survival, 54%. Just to put this in perspective, when Dr. Danilov mentioned about 15 years ago, we were treating patients with chemo immunotherapy, that unfortunately often included patients with TP53 aberration, where the median overall survival was only in the range of about 3 years. And here we see a median OS not even reached at 10 years with ibrutinib. So, really a revolutionary drug, but does have some side effects that we can see appearing at various times on therapy. And that's illustrated here from the RESONATE 2 study with 8 years of follow-up. So, this is a frontline population of patients who were older and had comorbidities. And the different colors of the bar graph here represents different years on ibrutinib where this toxicity first arose. So, you can see even 5, 6, 7 years into ibrutinib treatment, some of these toxicities are popping up, muscle spasms, pneumonia, arthralgias, these sorts of things. But also in the middle panel, hypertension, which also can arise later, atrial fibrillation, and of course the bleeding risks. So even though ibrutinib was very effective in this RESONATE 2 trial, only 42% of the patients were actually still on ibrutinib at 8 years. And by far the most common reason for discontinuation in this frontline setting was adverse events, which was about a quarter of patients. Now, this is actually in our clinical trial population who tends to be very fit and motivated and so forth. And so several real-world studies have now reported on ibrutinib and in sort of these retrospective series, including this one, for example, 41% of patients had discontinued ibrutinib at a median of just 17 months on therapy. And so this does suggest that in the real-world setting, it can be challenging to keep patients on long-term ibrutinib therapy. So this is really what inspired the development of the more specific BTK inhibitors, acalabrutinib and zanubrutinib, which are also now both approved. And I'll just show you one slide on each here. So this is the ELEVATE-TN study, which compared continuous acalabrutinib with or without a 6-month combination with obinutuzumab to obinutuzumab with chlorambucil as a fixed duration chemo immunotherapy regimen. So the left is 6 years of PFS data. Both of the acalabrutinib regimens were superior to obinutuzumab chlorambucil. Interestingly, although the study was not powered to show a difference here, in a post-hoc analysis, there was an advantage of the combination of acala-obin, 78% versus 62% 6-year PFS with acala monotherapy. In the top right and the bottom right, you can see these curves broken down by the different genetic markers. And as I showed you with ibrutinib, here you don't see a difference in IGHV status influencing PFS. You do see a little bit shorter PFS here with acalabrutinib based therapy, but still certainly looks very good with median PFS not reached at 6 years. These are some brand new data, updated data from the SEQUOIA study, which was the phase III study in the frontline setting of zanubrutinib continuous therapy versus BR. And this is now 5 years follow-up, which was just published in JCO. And you can see on the left, zanubrutinib was superior to BR. and on the right that zanubrutinib was again equally effective in patients with mutated or unmutated IGHV when given as a continuous therapy. So these are now kind of our preferred options, acalabrutinib or zanubrutinib. As I said, we're using less ibrutinib, and that's mainly due to the studies in the relapse setting, which showed more favorable toxicity profiles of these newer covalent BTK inhibitors. And I'm not going to review those data now. But I did want to show you the data for fixed duration venetoclax obinutuzumab. This regimen was approved now almost 6 years ago, and we do have 6 years of follow-up data that have been presented from the CLL14 trial, which randomized older patients and those with some comorbidities to a 1 year course of venetoclax with initial 6 month obinutuzumab combination, compared to a year of chlorambucil with initial 6 month obinutuzumab combination. And on the left, you see superior PFS of the venetoclax obinutuzumab. And this was the first report actually where they had a median PFS reached, so 76 months with 1 year of ven-obin therapy. And importantly, in CLL, remember that when patients progress radiographically, for example, they don't necessarily need to move on to a new therapy right away. So, with 6 years of follow-up, the median time to next treatment with ven-obin had not been reached, and about 65% of patients were still alive and progression-free and not requiring a new line of therapy in this population. Actually, some of those patients had progressed, but they had not required a new line of therapy. Now, interestingly, when we break this down by genetic markers, this is where we do see some differences. So, with TP53 in particular, we just see a little bit over a median 4 year PFS with venetoclax obinutuzumab. So, that is shorter than, for example, what I showed you with the covalent BTK inhibitors. But again, this is, as Dr. Danilov was alluding to, this is with just 1 year of therapy here, whereas the continuous BTK inhibitors are given obviously continuously throughout that time. Here, again, with IGHV status, there is an impact. So, one of the reasons I really favored ven-obin with IGHV mutated patients is that top curve there, where you see upwards of 75% or so of patients are still progression-free at the 6 year mark. Patients with unmutated IGHV also do very well, a little over a 5 year median PFS, but it is a bit shorter than you see in the mutated IGHV patients. So when these data first came out, there was some question, would they apply to a younger, fitter population? And CLL13 study helps to answer that question. So this compared patients who are younger, they were candidates for chemoimmunotherapy, and they were as to either an FCR or BR versus one of three different venetoclax-based fixed duration combination arms, venetoclax with rituximab, with obinutuzumab, or with a triplet of venetoclax, obinutuzumab, and ibrutinib. And you can see on the left the MRD rates in the bone marrow at the final restaging. Interestingly, both of the venetoclax obinutuzumab containing regimens were significantly higher than chemoimmunotherapy or ven-rituximab. So this is really one of the studies with randomized data that suggests to us that obinutuzumab is a more potent antibody in CLL compared to rituximab. And the rate with the triplet in terms of MRD is a bit higher. It's about 70% versus 70% with the doublet ven-obin. On the right, you can see with 3 years of follow-up that those curves are pretty overlapping in terms of PFS, in terms of triplet versus doublet. We've seen an update to this study where there's a little bit of separation with the triplet versus the doublet, but it's not a major difference. So I think as we were kind of alluding to earlier, the jury's still out a bit about triplet versus doublet, and I'm sure this is something we'll talk about more later. So as I sit with patients now and sort of help them to weigh the pros and cons of continuous BTK inhibitor-based therapy with time-limited ven-obin, we certainly have some benefits of the BTK inhibitors. They're very convenient to start. We don't need to use an infusion. We don't need to monitor for tumor lysis syndrome as we do with venetoclax. As I showed you, we have 10 years of data with ibrutinib, and we have some data for the efficacy of venetoclax after ibrutinib progression from a prospective trial. But on the other hand, it's an indefinite therapy. There is some potential for toxicities to occur later, including some cumulative risk of cardiac toxicity. And so venetoclax obinutuzumab is also very appealing because it's a 1 year time-limited therapy with no known cardiovascular or bleeding risks. There's less concern for long-term adherence. Most of our patients can kind of stick with a year of pills and be adherent there. There is potential for cost savings in this 1 year regimen and the possibility of retreatment in patients who later progress. I think really the main downsides as we talk about this with patients is logistics. It's a time-intensive regimen to get started on, particularly with the infusions and then the venetoclax ramp-up and the need for careful laboratory monitoring. So we'll talk just briefly now about the BTK plus BCL2 based regimens. I'll start with ibrutinib plus venetoclax. There's a number of different studies that have explored this. In the interest of time, I'll just show you what was the registrational study called GLOW, which is for older patients, 65 or older, or those with comorbidities, randomized 1-to-1 to a 15-cycle course of ibrutinib with venetoclax or a 6-month course of clorambucil with obinutuzumab. In the top right, you can see plus venetoclax was superior to clorambucil obinutuzumab. About two-thirds of the patients still alive and progression-free at about 4.5 years of follow-up here. And there was actually an overall survival improvement as well at that same time point. You can see the toxicity profiles highlighted in the table in the bottom left. One of the ones I bring to your attention is the cardiovascular side effects of ibrutinib plus venetoclax. So in this cohort of 106 patients, there were 4 patients who experienced death due to cardiovascular events while on treatment during that 15-cycle period. There was also a significant rate of infections and diarrhea and other issues with this regimen. And so this regimen did get approved by the EMA and is being used, as Dr. Danilov mentioned, in Europe. But there was hesitation about approving this here in the US, and the regimen was not approved here. And this was really largely due to the toxicity concerns. I think no one questions that this is an effective regimen, but particularly in our older CLL patients who have comorbidities, these were some concerning cardiovascular signals. And we've seen this with other studies of ibrutinib. And so this really opened the window to develop combinations with venetoclax that included the next generation BTK inhibitors that we discussed. And so we started this study, Dr. Brown and I at Dana-Farber back in 2018, a triplet study of acalabrutinib, venetoclax, and obinutuzumab. You can see the schema at the top there where we kind of introduce each of the drugs sequentially. There's a period of triplet-based therapy, and then the obinutuzumab finishes, and there's a doublet. And we developed this actually as an MRD-guided therapy. So after the initial 15 cycles, patients who had undetectable MRD and were in a complete remission could stop treatment at that point, whereas those patients who still had detectable MRD or were not in CR would go on to get an additional 9 cycles of the acalaven doublet. And then we had another MRD-guided decision point at that cycle 25 time point. And we did allow patients who still had detectable MRD at that time point to continue on acalabrutinib and venetoclax, although actually there were very few patients who needed to do so. And you can see that on the right based on the peripheral blood MRD rates in, for example, patients with TP53 aberration. These were quite high and actually comparable to the rates in patients without TP53 aberration. We had actually enriched this population such that close to two-thirds of the patients in this study had TP53 aberrant CLL. And in the lower left, you can see in the PFS curves that particularly the patients without TP53 aberration have done extremely well now with close to 5 years of follow-up. Patients with TP53 aberration are a bit shorter in terms of PFS, but I'll highlight that the PFS at 4 years here is 70%. And as you recall, with venetoclax obinutuzumab, the median PFS is about 4 years. So this does seem favorable, at least as we compare across studies to that earlier data set. And the overall survival here also looks very good. So this was a multi-center phase two study, I think practice informing, but not necessarily practice changing. Amplify, which Dr. Brown presented at the ASH meeting this year and was just published in the New England Journal of Medicine, I think is a practice-changing study. This is really the registrational trial to get approval for the AVO triplet and also the AV doublet. These regimens were compared to FCR or BR in a TP53 wild-type population. So this study excluded patients with high-risk CLL, defined by TP53 aberration. And these regimens were also fixed duration, so everyone got 14 cycles irrespective of MRD attainment. And you can see the MRD rates, particularly for the evaluable patients, were quite high with the AVO triplet in the range of about 95% at the end of treatment. They were a bit lower with the AV doublet at around 45%, but still patients did very well, particularly with regard to PFS. So here you can see the 3-year PFS looks quite good both for the AVO triplet and the AV doublet. Possibly a bit of an advantage with the AVO triplet, but again, this wasn't a primary comparison of this study, triplet versus doublet. Certainly both were superior to chemo immunotherapy. I'll mention also that this study was conducted really at the height of the COVID pandemic, and unfortunately there were some COVID-related deaths, particularly in patients who had not been vaccinated. And so there are some censored analyses, which I won't show here, but show particularly favorable progression-free survival with AVO, I think, in that context. So, final slide here, just as we look to the future, I think the AV doublet is going to be very attractive when it hopefully gets approved this year because it is a time-limited all-oral regimen. So, it takes away some of those convenience issues of infusions, but still, I think it's quite active. But I think a big question, and I'm sure we'll get to this in the panel discussion, is who do we use the AV doublet for versus who do we use VO for? And so, anticipating this question, we designed this study called MAGIC, which is a phase three global trial, which is about 600 patients and completed accrual last year. And this is including patients with high-risk disease and comparing the AV doublet to the VO doublet. A couple of factors that are interesting in this study are that it's an MRD-guided therapy regimen in both arms, so either basically 1 or 2 years, depending on an MRD assessment after the first year. And also that all patients actually stop treatment at the end of 24 cycles as a maximum. And we hope this will help clinicians to understand sort of some of the subgroups that may benefit more from one regimen versus the other. It'll be a little bit till we have these results, but I think as we await these results, it is, I think, challenging to figure out sort of who's optimal for which regimen. So with that, I think I will turn it back over to Dr. Brown.
Thank you, Dr. Davids, for that great overview. I think you already addressed the question of who we consider time-limited BCL-2 inhibitor-containing therapy for to some degree. But why don't we talk about what you mentioned? Who will we potentially consider for BTK-BCL-2 as compared to Ven-Oben?
Yeah, I can start. I think this is challenging because the data from AMPLIFY look very good, but it's only 3 years of follow-up. And with Ven-Oben, we do have 6 years of follow-up and a lot of experience now using that in the clinic. So I think for me, my default is mostly still going to be venetoclax obinutuzumab for most patients. But that being said, for patients who express a preference for an all-oral regimen, maybe from a logistics standpoint, it makes more sense for them. I'd certainly be very open to using AV. I may also lean a little bit more toward AV in patients who have bulky lymph node disease going into therapy. We've seen analyses with venetoclax obinutuzumab that those patients may have a shorter PFS than patients with less lymph node bulk. And that might be a particular advantage of the BTK inhibitor, particularly with that lead-in, to help reduce that lymph node bulk before starting the venetoclax ramp up. So those are some initial thoughts. I do think AV will be used fairly widely, but it is challenging to figure out which patients.
What do you think, Dr. Danilo?
Yeah, so I agree with what Dr. Davids is saying. I think we also want to put it in the perspective of what we do at academic medical centers ex versus what is being done in the community. And as you know, venetoclax obinutuzumab has not necessarily gained a whole lot of market share in community practices. Certainly, some community practices have gotten used to it, but many community practices find it much easier to start patients on BTK inhibitors. And I agree with Dr. Davids that this may help introduce novel doublets into community practices much easier because you start with a acalabrutinib in the A plus V regimen or AVO regimen, and that does make subsequent steps easier. So I suspect that we may be seeing even we may be seeing same or less use of venetoclax obinutuzumab and some increased use of AVO. In terms of what should really happen, I agree with Dr. Davids. We simply don't know. The follow-up on AMPLIFY study is still short. 3 years is a really short time for CLL, being a chronic disease where we have very good subsequent options following frontline therapy and where frontline therapies work so well. And if we start separating by mutated, unmutated IGHV, Dr. Davids mentioned already that there may be some difference there. There is some difference we already see in terms of AV versus AVO, say for unmutated IGHV, where AVO seems to have better PFS so far, and likely this will be sustained. For mutated IGHV CLL, those patients probably don't need obinutuzumab added to AV, at least based on the data that we see today at 3 years. So maybe that will at least somehow help us decide between AV and AVO. And regarding decision between AV, AVO, and Ven-G, I think it's really hard to determine now who is the best candidate for what because it's really difficult to compare these trials that exist. So I really look forward to what MAGIC will show, AV versus VNO that Dr. Davids has mentioned. Although AVO is not part of MAGIC, so we will need extra MAGIC now.
It's true. Still waiting for lots of
I do
data.
think Yeah, I mean, I do think it's obinutuzumab is a clearly a very active drug in CLL. So one of the things I struggle with is if I use AV in the frontline setting, then where do I use the obinutuzumab? Because I want to use it at some point in the course. In the relapse setting, we don't really have much data for venetoclax obinutuzumab. So yeah, that's one thought in terms of why I might use it up front now that we do have phase three data with AVO and our data to complement that in the high-risk patients as well from the phase two study. I
Yeah, in the
agree.
data you presented, we saw repeatedly that Obin adds significantly to whatever you're combining it with.
Yeah, pretty much every study seems to show that. And it is very tempting, I agree with you, to use it in frontline where we have the most data. We actually don't have that much data in relapsed disease with obinutuzumab. You're absolutely right. And I think particularly for younger patient, where there is a feeling that obinutuzumab does add to PFS and who knows how many years in the end of the day with this doublets, triplets, maybe 2 years, 3 years. So patient, maybe longer. So I agree with what Dr. Davids had said previously. There is a temptation to maximize response in the front line, and certainly obinutuzumab is a big contributor there.
All right, I think we better move on. So we'll turn it over to you, Dr. Danilov. You're going to take us through, oops,
Yeah.
sorry, managing
Yes.
CLL in the second line setting and beyond.
All right. Thank you so much. So we'll talk about second line setting, and there's been some exciting developments there as well. Bruin CLL321 study was presented at the most recent ASH. It enrolled patients with CLL, SLL previously treated with covalent BTK inhibitor. There was no limit on prior lines of therapy, and prior history of atrial fibrillation was allowed. This study did include patients with deletion 17p and prior venetoclax exposure. And patients were randomized to pirtobrutinib monotherapy, which is, of course, a non-covalent BTK inhibitor, which is administered once a day at this dose, or patients received either daratumumab and bendamustine/rituximab. And the majority of patients on this study received either daratumumab. So the data showed that pirtobrutinib was effective, and I immediately separated this by whether these patients had been exposed to venetoclax or not. And it seems that pirtobrutinib works a bit better as predicted in patients who are not double refractory yet. They have been previously treated with covalent BTK inhibitors, but they're venetoclax naive. And you can see that time to next, median time to next treatment here is about 30 months, which is quite significant for these patients who are progressing on covalent BTKIs, and certainly better than IDELA or BR. And then among patients who were venetoclax treated in the past, median time to next treatment was about 20 months. Among all patients, PFS was on the order of 14 months. So in some way, it may have been a little underwhelming, I would say. However, this was ended up being actually a fairly high-risk patient population with the majority of patients exposed both to venetoclax and covalent BTK inhibitor, many having aberrations in TP53 gene, and also the majority having unmutated IGHV. And as you have noticed, NCCN guidelines now do incorporate pirtobrutinib in a second line where it's technically not FDA approved yet, but we do anticipate that there may be a change in the label based on this study. Some older data, Elevate RR, a study which compared acalabrutinib versus ibrutinib in relapsed refractory CLL. And this was the first study which advanced selective BTK inhibitors versus ibrutinib. This study enrolled a high-risk patient population with deletion 17p or deletion 11q. And progression-free survival was similar between acalabrutinib and ibrutinib. However, acalabrutinib was substantially safer with lower risk of atrial fibrillation, hypertension, as well as other adverse events. On the other side, we have zanubrutinib ALPINE study, and this was a very audacious study in relapsed refractory CLL, which enrolled all comers, not just patients with high-risk CLL. And over several data cuts, we see continuously sustained improvement in progression-free survival for zanubrutinib versus ibrutinib, suggesting that in all comers, this is a more efficacious agent in relapsed refractory CLL. This also is maintained in patients with p53 aberrations. Overall survival so far looks similar, of course, in part because we have so many good options for patients with CLL/SLL. Just like acalabrutinib, zanubrutinib does seem like a much safer drug in terms of cardiovascular toxicities, but interestingly, the rate of hypertension is very similar. I do not believe that this studies by any means suggests that acalabrutinib is less efficacious than zanubrutinib. The studies are very different. They were run in different times, very different patient populations. I would say I personally use these drugs interchangeably, and they're both much safer than ibrutinib. And Dr. Davids alluded to cardiac deaths in the past, and these drugs do not have as much of that. And Murano study is another old study which compared VNR versus BR, which was one of the studies which essentially put a nail in the coffin of chemoimmunotherapy in CLL, relapsed refractory CLL, including deletion 17p, were randomized to between those two regimens. VNR was administered for a total of 2 years. There was a substantial improvement in progression-free survival and overall survival, of course, in a patient, including in patients with deletion 17p. There is always a question of what to do following a relapse after venetoclax and rituximab therapy in relapse setting, and I'm looking forward to the results of this study, which is also run by Dr. Davids, which is called REVENGE, venetoclax retreatment in patients who relapsed on first-line venetoclax obinutuzumab. And then we have in subsequent lines of therapy, some CAR T cell therapies, which have recently been approved, specifically liso-cel, which is a CD19-directed regimen. Very effective with complete response rate on the most recent update on the order of 20-30%. And patients who enter complete response can have very long duration of remission on CAR T cells. But of course, it is a toxic therapy associated with very high infectious risks in CLL, as well as cytokine release syndrome and potentially neurotoxicities. We have presented data on epcoritamab monotherapy. That's a bispecific antibody. Epcoritamab is approved in treatment of follicular lymphoma and diffuse large B-cell lymphoma in relapsed refractory setting after at least two prior lines of therapy. There were two cohorts in this study trying to mitigate CRS events by addition of this additional step-up dose at 3 mg epcoritamab. Most importantly, this was a very efficacious agent in a heavily pretreated patient population, including double refractory to BTK and BCL2 inhibitors, with overall response rate nearing 70%, complete response rate 30%, with MRD negativity at 10 to the minus 6 level, which is hard to imagine with a single agent in these patients, which have progressed through everything. Some of them progressed through CAR T and clinical trial based therapies. CRS was a problem, particularly in the original cohort, but it was quite well mitigated in this optimization cohort where most CRS cases were grade one. So nothing unexpected happened on this study in terms of toxicities. This was all consistent with what we see with bispecific antibodies. And then we have multiple BTK degraders in development that Dr. Brown has mentioned. And by far the most advanced data is with BGB-16673 and NX-5948. And we presented this, our group presented this data on 5948 at the most recent ASH. This is a multiple cohort phase one study. Dr. Shah presented this update where objective response rate in patients who were heavily pretreated, some of them also progressed on pirtobrutinib, was 84%. Of course, no complete responses as we expect with targeted therapies, and very safe, very well tolerated drug. As you can see, the grade three toxicity column is very modest. You see mostly ones or twos here, except for some neutropenia, which is very well managed in this patient population. So very impressive agents as well. Only one case of atrial fibrillation so far in a CLL patient with pre-existing AFib. So quite a lot of exciting developments in relapsed refractory CLL, including in double refractory CLL.
Thank you, Dr. Danilov. Great data. So we have these two approvals for pirtobrutinib and CAR T in patients who've been exposed to BTK and venetoclax. So how do you choose? Maybe I should.
Well,
No, go ahead.
oh yeah, okay. Sorry. Yeah, very, very good question. CAR T cells are tough. It's not a walk on the ocean breeze. Like I have mentioned, there are substantial complications with infections, and people say, oh, it's one and done. It's really not, right? So while the infusion may be one and done, the consequences of CAR T cell therapy, which includes CRS, neurotoxicity, infections, hypogammaglobulinemia, neutropenia, other cytopenias, they can persist for months and potentially years. These patients do get immune suppressed on top of the immune suppression that already exists in CLL. So I think we should administer CAR T cell therapy. So far, we should administer it very judiciously, and we should look for ways to improve on CAR T cell therapy in CLL. And some of these ways is combining with BTK inhibitors, as is being done, or investigating novel CAR T cell products. So by contrast, using pirtobrutinib is easy. I don't have a better word for that. It is easy. It's an oral agent with known toxicities, which is very well tolerated. Most of these patients have tolerated BTK inhibitors for years already, so they are highly unlikely to experience new toxicities on pirtobrutinib, and I have very positive experience with that agent. So I would say pirtobrutinib is a no-brainer first step, and then one can decide whether a patient is a good candidate for liso-cel or a clinical trial with CAR T cells or not.
Dr. Davis, would you recommend that people send their patients in to a specialty center?
I mean, I think it's helpful to get input right from the start, but that's not really. I do think patients who are progressing, even on frontline covalent BTK inhibitors, can be a high-risk group. So I think that's a good time point to think about referral. And then certainly patients who are double refractory, that's where clinical trials become a great option. Pirtobrutinib is certainly good for a short period of time, but as we saw from the BRUIN data that Dr. Danilov presented, median time to next treatment there are about 20 months or so. So especially for our younger patients, that's not so long. So yeah, I tend to have a similar approach as he has, where I've been using pirtobrutinib in that double refractory population, but also watching those patients closely and thinking about liso-cel if I start to see any early signs of progression.
Yeah, I think so far it is really so easy to use pirtobrutinib that it pretty much always ends up coming before liso-cel. Let's turn our attention briefly to toxicity, managing treatment-related adverse events. We've alluded to the fact that the BTK inhibitors' key side effects include atrial fibrillation, hypertension, bleeding, infections. The cardiac side effects are particularly great with ibrutinib, whereas the second-generation inhibitors, they're not as significant. We see headaches with acalabrutinib. Zanubrutinib may be a bit more neutropenia, and pirtobrutinib seems to have lower rates of these side effects so far. Whereas with venetoclax, we worry about tumor lysis syndrome, neutropenia, infections, and with the antibodies, it's all infusion reactions. Now, inevitably, when you combine drugs with separate toxicities, you do tend to get more toxicity. And certainly with the triple drug regimens, we definitely see more cytopenias. And even to some extent with the two drug regimens, we see more cytopenias. And so neutropenia tends to come to the fore on top of all the separate toxicities. And then in Amplify, because it's time limited for 14 months, and particularly with the two drug regimen, the side effects were really relatively limited. Very few cases of atrial fibrillation, limited hypertension. We still see infections and we still see neutropenia, and those were enhanced with the addition of obinutuzumab to AV. Now, I think a topic of concern to all of us is intolerance and how do we keep people on the drug so that they don't cycle through too quickly BTK inhibitors and venetoclax and get into that unfortunate double exposed, double refractory state. So you've got a patient. How are you finding the second generation BTK inhibitors are tolerated? And how much of a problem is intolerance these days? Dr. Davids.
Yeah,
Sorry, Dr. Danilov, whoever. Somebody jump in.
I could start. I mean, I think it's a lot less of a problem than it was with ibrutinib. I mean, quite a few patients with ibrutinib, you're always managing various toxicities, and I find that it's definitely less with these newer BTK inhibitors, but we still certainly see issues still, and some of the same issues that we saw with ibrutinib, arthralgias, for example, myalgias, these sorts of things. So I do sometimes have to adjust doses, for example, or hold doses. Bleeding events can still occur, of course. A common one, of course, with acalabrutinib is headache, which we often see early on as patients are getting used to that drug. I will note that with zanubrutinib, one of the nice benefits of the drug is it's right now it's four pills, so two pills twice a day, which gives a lot of maneuverability in terms of dose reductions. I'd say as a general principle, when I'm running into issues with toxicities and with patients, I will try dose reduction. Doesn't always work, but if even if it does work, I often try to get patients back up to full dose after a while and kind of rechallenge them. Some patients just need a lower dose and they end up staying on that lower dose and could do well. So that's kind of my approach. I think acalabrutinib has a little bit less flexibility in terms of dose reduction. You can go down to daily dosing, although the pharmacokinetics don't allow for as complete BTK coverage there. So I try to get, particularly with acalabrutinib, I try to get patients back up to full dose if they can tolerate it.
Yeah.
Down love. Patient gets AFib on their BTK inhibitor. How are you managing that these days?
Well, it depends how bad it is, honestly. So I don't think AFib or development of AFib becomes an absolute contraindication to continued use or first-time use of BTK inhibitors. And as you folks have published, these agents have been successfully combined with direct oral anticoagulants. If it is severe AFib, which results in ICU admission and difficulty controlling the rate, hypertension, then severe hypertension, that then it might be a problem. Then I might stay away from BTK inhibitors in the future, or at least it will give me a substantial pause. Have I done this following an event like that? Yeah, I had to do that a couple of times because this, say, for patients who didn't have other great options. And I have to admit, I have done that successfully, but it just wouldn't be my first choice. But, new AFib or paroxysmal AFib, which is found on a physical exam or an occasional EKG, often it would need potentially some rate control, optimization of cardiac therapies, figuring out what else is going on with the heart, maybe a conversation with a cardiologist. But often it can be managed while on BTK inhibitors.
Absolute contraindications to starting a BTK inhibitor. You have any anymore, Dr. Davids?
Yeah, I mean, certainly a recent severe cardiac event like an MI or severe heart failure, patients who've had major bleeding issues recently, major GI bleed, for example, those would be the sort of the absolute contraindication. I agree with Dr. Danilov, something like AFib, the factor plaques and a BTK inhibitor might more toward venetoclax, but if it's a patient who it's otherwise really wants to be on a BTK inhibitor and that's a good option, I it doesn't dissuade me.
Yeah, I guess still warfarin anticoagulation. There's still these patients who get stented and then CLL is found and they need treatment and they are on warfarin targeting higher, prosthetic valves targeting higher INR brackets, or even patients who get stented and they place on aspirin Plavix. I do get concerned about these patients as well because, anti-aggregant therapy, which really beats down platelets, does scare me a little bit, even more so than anticoagulation.
Yeah, dual antiplatelet therapy still scares me more, although I've been forced to it a few times recently, and it has generally been okay, but we still have so little data. Yeah. What about venetoclax? Absolute contraindications to venetoclax?
I would say, very severe renal dysfunction makes me nervous, a patient on dialysis, for example. But that being said, if they didn't have other options, I would still consider it. But certainly, if they had other options, I would lean more toward a BTK inhibitor.
Yeah, I think Non-compliance, right? So if I sense that somebody is non-compliant, I give them a starter pack and they disappear for a month and I can't do anything about it. I think that's an absolute contraindication.
Yeah, that would be bad. So thank you very much for joining us this evening. It's been a pleasure. I hope that you enjoyed the program.